From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, why the president is coming to Waukesha a day after delivering the State of the Union address.
Well, he goes where the manufacturing is, and there must be something about the GE gas engine plant that is quintessential to his economic message.
Next Act Theater tackles race in a play of the same name. We look back at the life and legacy of Milwaukee philanthropist, businesswoman, and educator Betty Quadracci, who died last month.
She wanted to make a difference in town. She wanted to be involved in the issues of the day. She wanted to promote the arts. She wanted to understand and profile people who were driving the city.
And we learn how Old World Wisconsin came to be. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. Welcome to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us this morning. President Obama will be in southeastern Wisconsin today, trying to call attention to the themes he sounded in Tuesday night's State of the Union address. The president will speak at a GE factory in Waukesha, in a county distinct for its conservative politics. Marty Michelson will cover the visit for WUWM News, and she joins us in the studio now for a preview. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning, Bonnie.
Great to see you. This isn't the first time the president has chosen to come to speak in Wisconsin in the days following a State of the Union address. Why do analysts think Wisconsin is an ideal place to take his message?
I think the president often chooses Wisconsin because it's a heavy manufacturing state. It provides a good backdrop to promote his economic policies. I spoke with UW Green Bay political scientist Michael Kraft, and he was saying people in Wisconsin are pretty reflective of the rest of the nation.
So why Wisconsin? In some ways, because the state is fairly typical of the country in terms of income distribution, in part because he did well here in the 2012 election.
Waukesha, on the other hand, isn't a place that is typically friendly to Democrats. What does that say about, of all of the places that he could speak, that he chose a factory in Waukesha?
Well, he goes where the manufacturing is, and there must be something about the GE gas engine plant that is quintessential to his economic message. But you are right. Waukesha is a Republican stronghold. So we may very well see demonstrations, people holding up signs across from the plant. A lot of people are upset about the Affordable Care Act, and we'll probably see that play out. However, I spoke with Marquette University political scientist John McAdams. He says, inside the plant, the mood will be respectful.
There's still a bit of a norm of civility in American politics, so appearances to the contrary. And even if you're talking about executives and indeed probably a lot of workers at General Electric that didn't vote for Obama and don't necessarily support Obama, they're going to be congenial. They're going to be polite. They're in fact going to be honored that the president is there.
So how much is electoral politics going to play into this visit? The president himself is done with elections, but there are important ones that are coming up in Wisconsin this year. Is he likely to reference the governor's race, for example?
It's highly doubtful he'll make any even subtle references to the governor's race, particularly when you consider he might be speaking to a more conservative audience. I think he'll stay away from that. Professor McAdams was saying there would be plenty of time later this year for the president to come to Wisconsin to support Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke if he chooses to do so. There will probably be some huge rallies as it gets closer to November.
Well, to that end, the political stage might be noteworthy for who it won't feature, which politicians have decided to sidestep this particular visit.
Well, rumors were swirling earlier this week that Mary Burke might appear with the president at some point during his visit, but her campaign quickly put an end to the scuttlebutt. Her advisors say she will be campaigning all day in western Wisconsin. Also bowing out is Waukesha Mayor Jeff Screma. He says he won't be attending the president's speech at GE because he doesn't want there to be an appearance of partisanship. The office of mayor, of course, is nonpartisan.
Well, you'll be at the speech, so we'll be looking forward to hearing your reports later today, Marty. Thank you so much for stopping by this morning.
Thank you.
Marty Michelson is part of WUWM's news team. We'll hear her report on President Obama's Wisconsin visit during All Things Considered, coming up later this afternoon. Coming up next, the legacy of the late Milwaukee publisher and philanthropist Betty Quadracci. It's the cover story of February's Milwaukee Magazine, and Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's been almost 2 months since Milwaukee Magazine president and publishing icon Betty Quadracci passed away, and people are still taking stock of her legacy. Quadracci co-founded the printing company Quad Graphics with her late husband Harry in 1971. The company purchased Milwaukee Magazine in the 1980s, and Quadracci served as its publisher until the middle of last year. But while Quadracci was well known for her role in the publishing industry, she's also being remembered for work as a philanthropist and as an educator. She founded the Waukesha Montessori School in 1965, and she helped create Waukesha's Head Start program 3 years later. Kurt Chandler and Ann Christensen both worked for years with Betty Quadracci in their roles at Milwaukee Magazine, and both were involved in putting together the tribute to Betty that appears in the February issue. They joined me in the studio shortly after her death in December. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Let's start with how Betty Quadracci shaped Milwaukee Magazine. She took it over and became publisher in the early 80s, right?
Quad Graphics bought the magazine. Harry and Betty bought the magazine in 1983. And Betty did not become publisher immediately. It was, I think, a few months, maybe a year before she assumed that role or was appointed that role, selected. And she had a little bit of a tough time at the start because people didn't take her seriously. They thought maybe this was just a job she could fill to kill some spare time.
They thought she was a dilettante in this sort of thing?
Yes, and she was not, as she proved over and over and over again. She really developed a vision, I think, for the magazine to do some edgy, hard-hitting reporting, and she wanted the best writers and photographers in not only the city but the state to contribute to the magazine. I mean, she wanted to make a difference in town. She wanted to be involved in the issues of the day. She wanted to promote the arts. She wanted to understand and profile people who were driving the city. And so it wasn't just another city magazine. It became a force that other local media were forced to reckon with. And if you compare it to other city magazines around the country, Milwaukee Magazine has had a national reputation for taking on those hard issues and being a little sassy at times, a little edgy and out front. And that was Betty's vision. It really was.
So it really wasn't like that before she took over?
I would say not. I mean, this was before my time, before Kurt's time, but the previous owners, it was a much different publication from what I've seen, because I've long gone through the archives of issues going back to the late 70s. At one point, the old WFMR owned the magazine. There was a very different voice there. And I would say for certain, you know, there wasn't that same kind of sense of the hard-edged and really, you know, getting at controversial issues.
Oh, yeah. Betty wanted the magazine to probe, and she wanted the magazine to take on sacred cows in Milwaukee. And it has over the years, and it will continue to. And that was not following anyone else's vision. That was Betty largely, and of course Harry, making that commitment. They had, I think, deep, deep feelings and convictions for the civic issues of Milwaukee. And as you see, as people see in their philanthropy, you know, they really were devoted to this city. And that, I think, came through in the magazine that they published.
You mentioned the word vision a couple of times, and I think that is a word that people seem to be associating with her across the board, whether it was with the magazine, whether it was with her philanthropic donations, whatever she attacked, it was with a vision in mind and with a real passion.
Well, you know, amongst ourselves, we've talked about how, and things I've observed many times over the years was just how much fire there was in her and her curiosity just about everything. And she worked harder probably than anybody I have ever seen, really. And you know, I've worked with a lot of editors. I've worked with a lot of writers who, and knowing the kind of being a workaholic and being a perfectionist and being that sort of having that sort of personality. I mean, she worked. I mean, she was tireless in the way she would attack things and approach things and the way she would run her business. She was, you know, extremely canny and very and just like people have said, the courage that she had. I think she just wouldn't really let go. And that came across when you would meet her in person, too. She's very, very warm. But also, I mean, she right away, you know, she wanted to know who you were and she focused in on you immediately and asked you a million questions.
It wasn't just lip service either. I mean, she had a genuine curiosity, really a reporter's curiosity, although she wasn't a journalist or didn't go to journalism school. Her mother did, interestingly. But Betty wanted to know about you. She wanted to know about the world. And she wanted to involve herself, engage herself in things around the city and the world. And she was challenging. She was direct. But she was also very charming. And she could win you over to her ideas and her commitment and devotion to issues and to really quality work.
Do you think it was the combination of that warmth and that sort of hard-headed, really laser focus that she had that made her so effective?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was a hands-on person. Whether she was sitting on the board of directors of the art museum or becoming involved with the arts community, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, or education. She was a Montessori teacher early in her career. I mean, she wasn't standing on the sidelines ever. She wanted to be involved. She wanted to get her hands dirty.
And she was a publisher, too, who, you know, although she wasn't doing like line-by-line editing, anything like that, I mean, she knew what we were working on and what our covers were going to be and had her own ideas about things and her own input, you know. But she also, you know, I never felt like she pushed, you know, any type of
She didn't
idea.
Have an agenda.
No,
or
she
anything.
Did nothing like that. You know, and I mean, I cover restaurants, and I felt like she always wanted to know. She always wanted to know what the hot new restaurants were. She always wanted to know that. But
she was playful too.
She was incredibly playful, and she always, you know, she always wanted to know where she could get a good burger, which seems really odd when you think about it. But no, this woman loved a good hamburger. She's very, you know, just a very simple type of thing like that, that is kind of universal. Everybody loves a burger, right? But she, you know, she'd get me in these conversations and I would sometimes just laugh. And she would just get this really cute little playful look in her face. And this was just talking about restaurants, you know. But she always, you know, she always wanted to know what you were working on and what are you doing and are you getting all the help you need? Are you working hard enough? I mean, she took a great interest in everybody on staff. You know?
So it sounds like a good boss.
A good boss, a tough boss. Again, a challenging boss, but she was inspiring. She really was because she engaged people. She did. She wanted to know genuinely what you were doing, what you were about, who did you talk to, and what else can you ask for in a publisher?
And she backed you up when things proved to be difficult?
She was embarrassed, I'm sure, among her circle of friends for really hard-hitting stories that the magazine did. She probably, you know, caught a lot of crap at social gatherings, but she never backed down and she always defended the magazine.
Always, always supportive. I mean, it didn't matter, you know, what it was. I mean, she stood by us.
Yeah, she did.
You know.
She had our back and that was important. I mean, that's what made the magazine as tough and in some cases strong and courageous as Betty was.
So how do you go forward then?
Well, her vision has shaped the magazine and has influenced various institutions in town, and the ship is still sailing. We're going to continue on that vision, on that mission, you know, with Betty as our inspiration, because that's where she took us and that's where we'll continue to move. I have no doubt that the magazine will continue on doing the quality work that she guided us towards, even though she's gone.
I feel like, you know, I think the worst thing would be if a magazine like ours, like mm-hmm. her magazine, mm-hmm. would not move forward. Mm-hmm. That's what she would want us to do. That would be a legacy, one of her legacies. And I can't see any other way.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sure we'll be questioning ourselves on a direction of an article or a cover or an art design. And we might even in the back of our heads be thinking,
what would Betty say?
What would Betty think about this? Absolutely.
What do you think Milwaukee has lost with her passing?
Well, they've lost an innovator, a visionary, and somebody who truly stood up for her convictions, for what she believed in. If you just look to the east and see that beautiful building along the lakefront, not only did she and Harry write a check to make that a reality, but they were involved, particularly Betty, in getting that building up. I'm talking about the art museum, of course, the Calatrava edition. And those kind of new leaders, I would call them, are very important to the city. And I don't think there are as many leaders such as Betty Quadracci in this town. And to lose one of them is a big loss.
I'm also going to speak just from gender, too, and say for women, you know, like myself, to see someone, a woman like this in power, a woman of this kind of power, was really inspiring. So, you know, I think of that part, too.
So we've lost that as well.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and talking a little bit about Betty and about her legacy. It is a big one and big shoes to fill.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Kurt Chandler is the chief editor of Milwaukee Magazine. Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic. The legacy of former Milwaukee Magazine publisher Betty Quadracci is the cover story in the February issue. Quadracci died in December at the age of 75. It seems sometimes that winter is the season when death is most around us. Lake Effect essayist George Burdes notices that notion.
There is something at once depressing and compelling about the approaching death that we know as winter. Leaves, green and trembling with the excitement of life such a short time ago, now lay prostrate, brown and decaying. Wildlife has retreated to darkened caves, tombs, really. The day's light is sullen, short. The signs of death surround us, overwhelming in their somber message. You too, they say, one day you know not when, your light will dim. You who now laugh and love and run will shrivel into black dust, like the leaves. To all of this, we hitch up our mental collars and lean into the wind. We try to forget. Icy blasts distract us. We rush to find shelter from it all. Death is not a gentle foe. Believe me, I know. After all, who can beat it? No matter what we do, it always wins. Its pervasive snows cover us. We hide, but it always finds us. Yes, winter is the time to think about death. What is this relentless hound that sniffs us out only to snuff us out? So cruel and savage is its bite that our fear keeps us from talking about it, even thinking about it. Have you ever noticed that, the secret din of our silence? For some, that silence about death is natural, even right. After all, they say, that's what death is, an endless, still void. There is no there. Why give thought and time to nothingness? They say this honestly, unflinchingly. Are they right? For others, death is a gnawing mystery, a dark puzzlement. Not doubters, but not believers either. We just don't know, they say. Is there a road so long that it never ends? They ask. Good question. And then, of course, there are still others, souls aglow, steeped in belief, giddy in trust. Death is not the end, it is the start. That's the sureness to which they cling. Silly fools, who's to say? Amid such competing confusion, rejection, wonder, and redeeming hope, only one thing seems certain. Winter is the time to think about death. Beneath winter's white, icy shroud lie hints to the riddle. Death is certain, inevitable, final. That's one message. But below that frozen cover, deep within the silence of it, lies another message. Its muffled murmurings are but whispers, low and indistinct, yet continuous. Listen sharply. Bend your ear close. The sound comes from voiceless lips. It rises from that which is dead. Hope is hard to hear. Promise hides in a spring too distant to see, to contemplate, or to believe. But look, look, how strange! The sound brings with it a light. See, see there in the dark void, a seed of light glimmers. What is it, that strange light? What is it called? The murmurer answers with a soft, gentle utterance. And this is what it says. It goes by the name Fulfilled Promise. From long ago it is called Light No Eye Has Seen. Rise to it.
Lake Effect essayist George Burdes lives part of the year in the North Woods and now deals with wintertime cabin fever in Milwaukee. Many of his essays first appeared on WXPR and on his blog East of Eagle River. He's sharing them now with us as well. Race the Play takes on Race the Issue on stage at Next Act Theater. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Of all the isms that are out there, racism is one of the most enduring and, in this supposedly post-racial age, the most pernicious. It can be hard for people of different races to even talk openly with each other about how race has impacted them without the conversation devolving into accusations. And that makes any change in race relations that much more difficult to achieve. Next Act Theater is throwing open that conversational door with its production of David Mamet's play, Race. Mamet is known for his biting and unsparing dialogue, and he's true to form here. I recently sat down to talk with the director, Edward Morgan, and the cast, David Cesarini, who's also the producing artistic director of Next Act, Tiffany Renee Johnson, Lee Palmer, and Jonathan Smoots. Morgan says this play offers a fresh take on the subject.
It's a very different kind of look at race, more about an analysis of how race relations have affected the people through all the institutions in this country right now in the present. And in that sense, it felt really fresh. I haven't read or seen a play quite like this before.
So I have to say, I feel the same way having read it, that, you know, I'm hearing dialogue that I'm not sure that we ever really hear in a public forum. Maybe it's a private thing, but I'm not sure that I do. And I want everybody to jump in here. I mean, what does Mamet bring to this discussion that we need to have in this country?
I do think that there's dialogue that we don't often see. I think that the dialogue in race kind of encourages us, challenges us to, as actors and the people who will view the play, to think about the prejudices that we all have and to maybe shift a bit and to change perhaps how we look at people who are different from us. Yeah, and to just talk about it. I think talking about it is important, and this is a show that will definitely be an impetus for conversation.
I guess we probably should set up the play, and maybe, David, you can set up where we are and who these four people are.
Sure. Jack and Henry form a law firm. They've been together 20 years, a black lawyer and a white lawyer. We assume they're in a cosmopolitan city of some sort, could be New York, could be Chicago. There is a big case that's been out there. It's been in the papers of a elderly. Yeah,
sorry. I beg your pardon.
Not so elderly.
60-ish.
60.
Rich guy, rich white guy, who's out there, and he has been accused. We will soon learn of a horrible assault on a young black woman, and he suddenly shows up at our doorstep. That's the beginning of the play. There he is. We have no knowledge that he was on his way, and we're adjusting to him right there. And that is Charles Strickland. The fourth character is Susan, who we have just hired in our law firm, maybe we figured a couple of months ago, as a young, ready-to-go lawyer, but she's our rookie, and she's sort of Jack's project, and he takes time out as the play goes along to grill, to chat, to learn from, to glean information, to get her to think and process what's going on.
And so why do you think Jack rather than Henry? Because that would be probably the obvious connection, because you're both black. And so I think the audience, again, that's an assumption, that they might assume you as Henry would be the mentor, but you don't like her.
No, Henry's old-fashioned and old-school. When you think about the two characters of him and Susan, he believes in saying yes, sir, yes, ma'am. He comes from a Southern background. He believes that respect should be in place, but he thinks of the young people as bypassing that and not doing that. And so when she first comes in for the interview, he has concerns about hiring her. He doesn't want her to be a part of it because he's looking for a different type of young person to be in the law firm. And Jack kind of overrides him and decides to hire her anyway. And he has his suspicions, and they don't never go away. So you would maybe assume that would happen, but there's that divide, which you could also call a prejudice as far as age, even in the same race.
Right. I mean, the thing that's, to me, wonderful about this play is that there isn't anything that he's not poking at and holding up and saying, wait a minute. One of the things is the law itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is not kind. but not in a stereotypical way. It's not like all lawyers are bad.
No. Well, he's also not untruthful in describing what really goes on in the courtroom. As he says, you don't go for the truth, you go to win. There are no facts to this case. There are two fictions, which the opposing teams will try to impress upon the jury. That's what happens in courtrooms. And I see some of our board members who are lawyers, when I quote that, nodding their heads and saying, yeah, that's kind of what goes on.
So much for justice is blind?
Well, exactly. And that's what I think, an illusion that we have on the outside, or that we have watching Law and Order all the time. I liken this to a really good middle part of a Law and Order episode, when the lawyers are trying to figure it out. I was also struck when I first read the play, I could not stop reading the play till I was finished. That was one thing that struck me and stuck with me today. It's really well written. It's incredibly engaging in that sense. And I'll tell you, the dialogue's really hard to learn because Mamet's language is all his own. It's English and it's recognizable, but his syntax is all twisted up in his own way. And it works. It's unique, but it's tough.
The two of you have a lot of that dialogue. I mean, you guys really are firing off each other because you also have that 20-year history, too.
We've been friends for a long time, and we're good lawyers. We're well-known in this particular city. And, yes, like he was saying, the dialogue is incredibly hard, but you have to stay on top of it because it is Mamet. It is his words, and it really does tell a story in a different way. And, it really does attack. And I heard something where in the system, if there's no innocence, it's either guilty or not guilty. And exactly what does that mean? And I think what the people will find out, what the audience will find out, is we kind of explain that a little bit more.
And Jonathan, for you, and you're sort of the catalyst that starts this whole thing going, or at least your predicament does.
Yeah. Well, my character sees himself as a good guy. A good guy who has no race prejudice that he knows of, and who has lived an upright and decent life. And I think a lot of people in the audience will recognize themselves in me. And the play, and what I like about the play more than anything, is how absolutely blunt it is. And you asked, your first question was about what makes a play different or special. And it's we talk about things in such a direct way that black and white people do not. It's not polite. It's not proper. It's not polite. It's not politically correct to say these things out loud. But it's the very kind of dialogue that I think will help undo the prejudice that has this country and the whole world in its stranglehold.
And what about you?
I too think it's very, very direct, and it is blatant, and it's shocking. When I read the play, I was like, whoa, Mehmet is going there. And as I said before, it's a lot of things that we would not say to each other are in this play, and it's interesting to be able to have that dialogue as actors. But I do think that it's written in a way that will have people kind of on the edge of their seats and so shocked about how things are expressed, but shocked into thought and shocked into conversation and hopefully shocked into change. You know, I think that's the beauty of the language, though it might hit you like, whoa. I think it's great because it will inspire a plethora of things.
For me, it was like, my gosh, did he really just say that? Did they really just say that to each other? Because it's not like any of us are innocent of thinking those things. We all have our prejudices, but most of us like to think that we have somehow gone past that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mm-hmm. who he's talking to, all of us. Mm-hmm. All of us are guilty of something prejudicial.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
In the first rehearsal, our director told us to feel comfortable to say anything to each other, and it was really necessary. That was really refreshing for me because I asked questions of black people. I grew up in a lily white community. I now know black people and have black friends, but when I growing up, I sure didn't. And there's just silly, everyday things that we can ask each other that we would never ask because it's too embarrassing.
Like what?
Oh, gosh, what did I... You guys are...
You had a couple good ones.
Yeah, wait, let me think of one.
You would remember better than me.
Oh, one he asked today, this may not be the best one, but he was asking about whether it was kind of less likely for black men to grow hair out of their ears than white men, because...
No, that's just old men, Jonathan.
No.
He noticed that Lee doesn't have hair growing out of his ears, and Jonathan does, so he asked me, so he's like, so I was wondering, is that like a black thing? Like, and I was like, I'm not sure. But.
See, now, I would never have asked that under ordinary circumstances. But all the
you do see it when you get to be 80s and 90s.
Oh, okay.
But not as early as you were talking about.
And so were there questions that you two asked of whites?
Well, you know, what was interesting was just sharing stories. Like, I've known these gentlemen for 30 years or so. And just to be able to talk about some things that we never spoke about was just really, really refreshing. You know, you just shared stories about growing up. I grew up in the South in the early 60s. So I saw the signs. I saw, you know, colored people only, same in bathrooms. I remember going to restaurants in the back of the restaurants, you know, where you could order but you couldn't sit inside, or going to the movies where you had to sit upstairs, and being able to share these stories that these guys have never heard from me before. But this play brings that kind of stuff out, and you really put it on the table. And it's just refreshing to rehearse that way and talk about things like that.
Yeah, unless the play seem too much to be A, heavy, or B, about shock, I think ultimately Mamet's point of view is ironic. And I think what's interesting is that he's pulling the rug out from under all these folks. And there's a lot of humor and a lot of intelligence behind it. Its real force, I think, is its intelligence and not quite a satiric but an ironic bite rather than dramatic weight, I think. The tone of the color in that sense of the piece in that way is both unique and again, a different way than we usually talk about race.
So do you hope, as a cast and you as the director, that people are really going to just be talking about this and maybe sparking something bigger in terms of dialogue? I mean, we certainly know here in Milwaukee, race is a huge issue, and it never goes away, and it's talked around. Sometimes it's talked about directly, but it's usually talked kind of around it in soft terms.
I would like to see the show make people talk about it. We talk around things far too often. So I would like for people to be entertained. I would like for them to be captured. I would like for them to think. I would like for them to be inspired to really talk and to not be afraid to talk about it. Because, you know, if you push the fear aside, you know, you can get to where you need to go.
I have this dream that people will start to think in terms of the separation of rich and poor and mm-hmm. forget about color. And
Certainly plays a part in this.
Yeah, yeah. It plays some part in this. And I said that to Lee the other day. I said, do you think maybe whites and blacks will hold hands and realize that we've got more in this game than we need a living wage. We need this. And I said, you think that'll happen? He said, well, I don't think so.
So you don't think so, huh?
No, the rich 1%, no. I mean, will they ever give it back? Will they share it amongst us all? I mean, how many things could change if that money could be spread out? You know, and people, like you said, people are needing jobs, and you just want to see, you know, like you said, black and white coming together, because there's a lot more of us, middle and lower class, of all races than there are up there as far as the billionaires go. So we, as a people like that, even economically, need to look at that and work together to make those changes.
You think this play will help?
I think even if it gets people talking about it and wanting to do something differently or wanting to help, even if it gets them talking about it, it's a change.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they will talk about it.
Yeah, I think he's contributing a different voice to the ongoing discussion about how race history and present race issues affect all of us. You know, there's some accurate analysis of how it affects all of us in there. Yeah. So in that way, it's another voice. It's an interesting voice.
And David, this is like smack in the middle of NECSAC's mission.
Yeah, we like to put things on the table for people to talk about. An interesting twist with this particular play, this particular playwright, he has put into his publication contracts that a prohibition on talkbacks for a period of 2 hours after the show comes down.
Really?
Yes, indeed. Which you would think would be kind of odd, especially for a play like this. So we are going to encourage in some form or other discussion amongst our patrons, and we'll figure that out as we go along. But yeah, we certainly look forward to hearing from our people on the web and you know, that sort of feedback.
It bothers me when people pretend as if we are living in a post-racial society, because in my opinion, there are specific instances which remind us that we are not there at all, and that is why we have to talk about it. And I think talking about it could lead to some people's opinions being shifted, because we can't just talk about it. Someone's mind has to change. You know, it's great to be in the company of people who believe in justice and who believe in equality, but there are so many other people who have power to take matters into their own hands and to take lives away. So how do we change those minds?
What I find interesting about this play is that he doesn't offer answers. Nope. At least not to me.
Right.
You know, I mean, he doesn't actually say, here's a prescription about how to change this. He's just kind of showing it.
Audacious as he can be, he's not that audacious, I don't think, to go that far. Yeah. I think he offers kind of an interesting example of Henry and Jack's relationship. They at least are able to share openly their ideas and opinions and perspectives from his own culture. There's something to be said there. Is a solution that simply talking. We have to be more free and open to share honest opinions and perspectives about each other and the issues.
I would say it's a virtue of the play that it doesn't prescribe answers, that it raises questions.
Yeah.
I think it's a much more interesting play for that, yeah, and more likely to provoke thought because it doesn't preach.
Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time out of rehearsal to talk to me and break a leg. This is going to be a fantastic production.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
David Cesarini, Tiffany Renee Johnson, Lee Palmer, and Jonathan Smoots all star in David Mamet's play Race, opening tonight at Next Act Theater. Edward Morgan directs the show. I spoke with all of them in Next Act's rehearsal hall, and there is a link to more information about the production at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then coming up next, a recent book reveals how Old World Wisconsin came to be. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Since the mid-1970s, Old World Wisconsin has preserved and brought to life the state's rich ethnic heritage. As the largest outdoor museum of rural life in the country, Old World demonstrates how our immigrant ancestors lived through heirloom gardens, antique machinery, and painstakingly restored buildings. But a living history museum doesn't come together by itself, and perhaps we've taken for granted the history of the institution itself. That's being rectified in a new book by Marquette University professor John Krugler called Creating Old World Wisconsin. He told Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce, who first came up with the idea for the museum.
Well, the man that's generally credited with is a Milwaukee architect by the name of Richard W. E. Perrin. And Mr. Perrin started going into the field in about 1928-29. And what he was very much interested in, besides his jobs in Milwaukee as an architect, he was very interested in vernacular or folk architecture. And his crusade was launched when he said, as he said at one point, he said, every year I went out into the field and more of these specimens disappeared. And so it was almost as if a blanket or a shroud had begun to cover the 19th century. And this was especially true after World War II when Americans began to move into the rural areas and these old houses had no attraction to them. So they were either torn down or they'd be remodeled and you wouldn't even be able to tell what the original fabric was. So Mr. Perrin, in 1960, measured the Kepsel House in the town of Jackson near the Jackson Marsh in Washington County. He convinced the farmer to donate the building to the Historical Society. Now, in that same month, he approached the society, who had a new director, Dr. Leslie H. Fischel, who was the seventh director of the society. And Fischel probably would have been well advised to simply say, well, Mr. Perrin, this is wonderful, but we just don't have the resources. But Perrin was persistent, and in 1964, he went before the Board of Curators and made a very convincing argument that they needed to endorse this idea of capturing, saving, preserving, rescuing, salvaging, however you want to describe it, and bringing them to a common site. So that would be the origins of it. One man who had worked with other architects and saw the need for state intervention in terms of preservation.
Now, had the Society ever taken on a project like this before?
Traditionally, this Wisconsin Historical Society was nationally known for its archives and library, and it had a wonderful archival collection, and that's where they spent most of their time and energy, that and the books. The state's historical library was the library, the American History Library for the University of Wisconsin. So you can see it was a very, very massive and important undertaking. There were many who worried that if the society got into historic sites, it was going to be a disaster from a budgetary standpoint because I won't say they lived a hand-to-mouth existence, but it was close to that. They were pretty much at subsistence level. Beginning in late 1940s, the Society began to think about, we have to have more to our mission than just serving scholars. We need to get into what was derisively called popular history. And popular history was most generally effective by using historic sites. So by 1953, the Society had acquired three sites. They were existing sites. The DNR owned them. And so the Society began to manage them and administer the sites. But no, they had never tried to create a museum from scratch. And so this became an incredible challenge because, A, they didn't have enough money to do it. B, they had no experience. There were no manuals. There were no how do you build a museum booklets out there for them. So they simply went into it kind of on a wing and a prayer.
What were the options before them? They had this capsule building that was donated to them by Mr. Perrin. What then were the options before them in terms of what they could do with this building?
Well, the most important thing and the one that took the most time was acquiring the site. Now, they had looked at Bong Air Base, which was going to be released by the United States government, but that didn't happen until the mid-70s, so that really wouldn't have been an effective choice. Their eye kind of was set on that wonderful state forest, the Southern Kettle Moraine Forest at Eagle. And that was where most of their planning went. Now, this was a great situation because much of the forest they wanted was owned by the Department of Natural Resources, a state agency. The society was a state agency. So, gee, it should be very easy to affect this. But because of state law and because of reluctance on the part of the DNR, they could not affect this lease until 1971. So it was 10 years that the struggle to get the site went on. So that was probably the biggest consideration. It took an awful lot of time. But I think in terms of your question, the capsule house, I said it was donated. I didn't say it was taken to any place by the society. In 1969, the society said, you know, we better go out there and see what's happened with the capsule house. And so they sent Jack Wynn out there, and he was able to reestablish a relationship with the family and eventually got the building to be donated. What I'm suggesting here is that this was a long and in many ways a very torturous process, in large part fueled by the fact the society really didn't have enough money to be doing this. And so it was kind of a hand-to-mouth existence for them to get the museum started. The crews scoured the state, and they began to find buildings they wanted in Polk County, Dane County, Dodge County, Rock County. So they were all over the state looking for buildings.
You talked about the lack of funding, but I wonder that example of what happened with the capsule house seems to be a perfect example of the lack of experience going into this. What maybe could have been done differently had there been someone who really knew how to bring these buildings to this site properly?
Let me start by quoting my favorite 19th century humorist, Mark Twain, who said, "The lack of money is the root of all evil." So most of the problems that the society encountered was due to the fact that they simply didn't have enough money to be able to do what they wanted to do. The people that supported it were very enthusiastic, and they really, really were pushing very hard. In terms of what they could have done differently, I think if they'd have done anything differently, the museum would not have happened. There's almost a genius in the way they did this, and Les Fischel, when I interviewed him, said that, you know, his approach was to do it incrementally, one step at a time. I had seen that in the records, but I hadn't recognized it. And so after he said that, then I realized, wow, you know, this is just exactly what they were doing. So they went after the site. That got to be a long and drawn-out, protracted struggle. The most interesting thing about what could they have done differently, the obvious choice would have been to go to a professional planner. You know what? That costs a lot of money. So the question became, how can we get a master plan virtually for free? Fischel called the head of the landscape architecture department. He said, we have this project that we're thinking about doing, and I need somebody who might be able to put together a master plan. And the head of the department says, well, we just hired this new young guy from Harvard. He's been here about a year now, but he really loves old buildings. Well, loving old buildings and building a museum plan are two different things. This is one of the things that got me into writing this book, is because I interviewed Bill Tischler in 1993 and 1994. I was working on a different project at the time, and I was so fascinated by his story. As a college professor, you know, you kind of know how far you can push your students, and I try to push them to the nth degree. But Bill started with a design studio class in second semester of 1966-67, and he had 16 undergraduate students. 15 men and one woman, and that class put together four preliminary plans for the museum, and they made a presentation to the faculty of the Landscape Architecture Department in June of 1967. That was enthusiastically endorsed, and then they went on to meet with the curators and sold the plans to them, and they again enthusiastically endorsed the plans.
Well, once they had the site established by 1971, I believe you said.
Well, the site was transferred, and then they began working on the site in 72.
It was a short amount of time to 1976 when the site actually opened. That's a lot to have happened in a five-year period. Talk about the dominoes that fell to get this museum together.
Well, first of all, let me start with Alan Pape, who was the construction supervisor. He went to his supervisor and said, you know, we need a lot of people to be re-erecting these buildings. And his supervisor said, hire cheap, you know. And so Alan, at least for the first couple of summers, relied on local high schoolers to do the work. Anything, and Mr. Perrin endorses, if the public couldn't see it, then you can do anything you want. Now, I mean, you know, that's not exactly the kind of workmanship you'd like. You'd like somebody who's maybe got 20 years in on reconstructions, restorations. So they had to rely on very inexperienced workers. So that was a complicating problem. It meant that Alan would have to be there supervising frequently. But Alan also was in the field. Why was he in the field? He was looking for buildings. And the number of trips that gone up to Bayfield County and found some wonderful specimens that are in the museum from the finish. And they also found Ed Putis, who was a Finn, who was a carpenter. And so they co-opted him and brought him down. And so he was more or less the supervising supervisor for the construction of the finished buildings that they had brought back. In addition to trying to find the buildings, which was very exhausting, and Alan was, a number of people have told me, he told me himself, no brag, just fact, he could see a 19th century building where others couldn't. But from 1973, when the first construction started in June, until June 30th, 1976, 3 years to get the museum built.
So what was opening day like?
The people that were responsible for planning, they thought maybe 2,000, but we, you know, planned for 5,000. They had accepted estimate was between 8,000 and 12,000 people to Eagle. Now, they probably should have been able to figure it out that this was going to be a big attraction, A, for the publicity, but, you know, Wisconsins love anything that's free. And so these Wisconsinites came in great numbers. They literally flooded the site. There were so many problems on site, it's mind-boggling. The Ramsey Barn was going to be the visitor center. It wasn't ready. There was no water on site because the well digger took off a couple weeks before the site opened. St. Peter's Church, the painters went on strike, so they didn't have the painting completed. They received their slideshow the morning of the opening, and they had no place to show it. So, you know, they thought, well, we'll use the basement of St. Peter's Church, which was now nearing completion. The problem there was they had no electricity. So what they did is they brought a generator. Generators make big noise. And so you have these people filing down into the basement of St. Peter's to see the slideshow with a, you know, an audio and can't hear it.
How did then Old World Wisconsin survive this day when everything that could go wrong went wrong? I mean, what went right? Something obviously went right because Old World Wisconsin survived after this and today is thriving.
What went right about this? Well, a lot of things went right. By the time the second season opens in 1977, they've already made great strides. It was a tease in 1976, a kind of showing you this is what we might be able to become. I think they had, the numbers are 67 re-erected buildings, historic buildings. It wasn't what they planned, but it was much more than the state deserved out of, you know, what the resources were.
Well, John Krugler, thank you so much for coming in and telling us the story of creating Old World Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
John Krugler is a professor of early American history and public history at Marquette University. His latest book is Creating Old World Wisconsin, The Struggle to Build an Outdoor History Museum of Ethnic Architecture. There's a link to more information about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. It's been great having your company. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.